Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, March 5, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing once again the case Halliburton versus Eric P. John Fund, argued today in the U.S. Supreme Court. I am Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear today from one expert. It's Mr. Jeffrey B. Wall. He is special counsel at the Washington, D.C. office of Sullivan and Cromwell. He was good enough to attend oral argument this morning in our case, the Halliburton case. This is not Groundhog Day. We did have a teleforum on this same case yesterday, sort of a preview, but now with a report first giving some background on the case and then recapping the oral argument, we have Jeffrey Wall, again, of Sullivan and Cromwell. With that, Mr. Wall, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. So I should say right off the bat that I've been involved in the Halliburton case. I represented a group of former members of Congress and congressional staffers and senior SEC officials who were involved in drafting the PLSRA, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, back in 1995. One of the arguments that featured fairly prominently in the briefs and again today at argument was whether in enacting the PLSRA in the mid-90s, Congress had effectively ratified or acquiesced in the basic presumption that we're going to talk about on the call today. And I represented some amici who argued that the PLSRA did not acquiesce in or ratify the basic presumption. So I thought I'd start with just a bit of background, and I won't do too much on it since there was a call yesterday, and I'm sure if you all want to know how the oral argument went, you know at least a little bit about the case. But we're talking about private securities fraud suits under Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and Rule 10B-5 promulgated by the SEC. Now, the Exchange Act doesn't explicitly give private parties the right to bring securities fraud claims, but the court has implied a private right of action. So before the Supreme Court's decision in BASIC, it was fairly difficult to bring shareholder securities fraud class actions for plaintiffs to bring as a group or on a class basis, because they couldn't show reliance as a class. The plaintiffs would have to show that each class member actually considered and believed the alleged fraudulent statement when buying or selling his or her shares. And as a result, it was very difficult for plaintiffs as a class to meet the traditional reliance requirement. And that's hugely important as a practical matter, because as the folks, as Steve Bradbury talked about on the phone in yesterday's call, if a case survives class certification, there is tremendous pressure to settle, and cases virtually always do settle. Only a handful of cases in the last 20 years or so have actually gone to trial. So much rests on whether a class can be certified, and if reliance, which is an element of the private cause of action, the court said that several times, if that can't be shown on a class-wide basis, then the class can't be certified. So it's tremendously important to both plaintiffs and defendants. So in 1988, the Supreme Court decided BASIC versus Levinson, and it endorsed the so-called fraud on the market presumption. And basically, that kind of rests on two premises that the court talked about in BASIC. The first is that markets are generally efficient, what's called the efficient capital markets hypothesis. And so markets incorporate information, including material misrepresentations made in connection with a given security. And the second premise is that investors rely on the integrity of those prices, and thus they have, in effect, relied on the misrepresentations because the misrepresentations are reflected in the stock price. That's the first part, that the market's efficient. And then investors rely on those prices when they purchase and sell securities. That's the second part. It was a 4-2 decision. Only six justices participated. Justice Blackmun wrote the majority decision for himself, and Justices Brennan, Marshall, and Stevens. Justice White dissented, joined by Justice O'Connor, basically, and contested both of the premises. Justice White argued in dissent both that the economic theory that the court was adopting about the efficiency of capital markets was relatively new and had not been sufficiently tested to be adopted by the court. And he argued investors often don't rely on the integrity of market prices. Indeed, they are often trying to beat the market because they think those prices are inaccurate for one reason or another. The court said in basic that the presumption is supposed to be rebuttable by any showing that severs the causal link. So, for example, if the alleged misrepresentation did not distort the stock price, didn't impact the stock price in any way, that would sever the causal link. It would show that the misrepresentation was not, in effect, passed on to a plaintiff through the plaintiff's reliance on a given stock price. You could also show that a market wasn't efficient or that a particular plaintiff didn't rely on the market price for some reason. Again, maybe that plaintiff thought that the price was inaccurate and was trying to beat the market. So the petitioners in the Halliburton case have basically made the same two arguments that Justices White and O'Connor made in dissent in basic. They've argued that the premises have been eroded by intervening scholarship by economists who have shown in Halliburton's view that markets are not always efficient. They don't always incorporate instantly new material information. And they've also shown that investors don't always rely on prices. And Halliburton argues the presumption has effectively become irrebuttable in a way that the basic court did not intend. As it comes to the court, there are two questions presented. The first is whether to overrule its previous decision in basic. And the second is, even if it doesn't overrule basic and it allows plaintiffs to invoke a presumption of reliance by saying that they have purchased a security that trades in an efficient market, what are the circumstances in which they should be able to invoke that presumption? And specifically, should plaintiffs be required to show that the alleged misrepresentation had an impact on the price of the security, or at the least should defendants be able to rebut the use of the presumption by showing that the misrepresentation didn't affect the stock price? So this is what's called price impact. If you read the transcript, which has just come up online, there's a lot of talk at the court this morning about price impact, and that's what they're talking about. They're talking about the second question in the case. So assuming that some form of the presumption survives, what are the circumstances in which plaintiffs can invoke it or defendants can rebut the use of the presumption? So that's the background on the case, and I thought I'd talk briefly about what happened this morning. You know, with the caveat that it's often difficult to tell much from the oral argument. The justices asked difficult questions of both sides, and it's not always possible to get a read on where the court is moving. And a part of it is just impressionistic. Sometimes the transcript doesn't tell the whole story because it's difficult to convey the tone and sometimes the tenor of the justices' questions. But with those caveats, I think the most interesting thing about this morning was that leading up to the argument, much of the discussion about the case focused on the first question, whether the court should overrule its previous decision in basic and require plaintiffs to show actual reliance in securities fraud cases. And again, that'd be very difficult for many investors to do because they would not have read the prospectus or heard the relevant statement. Some investors might have, but it'd be very difficult to show that for some investors, and as a result, you couldn't show it on a class-wide basis. It would be an individualized question. At the argument, however, the court concentrated much more on the second question than the first, the circumstances in which plaintiffs should be able to invoke or defendants should be able to rebut a presumption of reliance, which suggests that at least some of the justices are interested in retaining the basic presumption, but doing so in a way that could alter the current landscape. And for those of you monitoring the early press reports, that seems to be the feedback from the Supreme Court press. The ones who were at the argument seem to think that it's difficult to think that there's a coalition of five or more justices who would vote to overrule BASIC. And the interest this morning seemed to be more in determining how the presumption would work in practice if, in fact, BASIC survives in some form. So early in the argument, Justice Kagan asked Aaron Street, who was arguing for Halliburton, what had changed since BASIC to justify overruling that decision. And Aaron responded that, among other things, the premises underlying BASIC, that markets are perfectly efficient and that investors rely on the integrity of those market prices, those premises have been eroded by intervening economic scholarship. And the Chief Justice asked at that point a very interesting question. He said, well, how do I settle that economic debate? If markets incorporate information much of the time, as you, Halliburton, acknowledge, but if they're not perfect in incorporating information, as the fund acknowledges, what do I do? How do I resolve that debate in the economic literature over just how efficient markets are? And the reason I say the question is interesting, both because I don't think that there was a clear answer from the argument, and because I think from that point in the argument, the questions began to shift much less about the efficiency of markets and academic theory and the continued viability of BASIC, and they became much more about how a presumption of reliance should function in practice. And so I wonder if the Chief Justice's question indicated a more general concern on the part of other justices with wading in to the debate, the economic debate, over the efficiency of capital markets and whether investors rely on the integrity of market prices. And so fairly early on in the petitioner's argument, the questions really began to shift to the second question in the case. And Aaron got several questions about whether price impact, which again is whether the alleged misrepresentation affected the price of the security, whether that should be shown at the class certification stage or should be deferred to the merits. And again, that's hugely important because class certification is often the ballgame in these cases, because for the cases that survive class certification, as I say, the vast majority settle rather than proceeding to an actual verdict on the merits. So Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, all asked questions suggesting that price impact is an issue that's common to the class. Either the misrepresentation affected the price or it didn't, but the answer to that is the same for every member of the class. So there's no need to resolve it at class certification. You can defer that to the merits. And at that point, or around that point in the argument, Justice Kennedy asked Halliburton's counsel to address an argument made by a group of law professors as amici curiae that courts should focus on price impact at the class certification stage through the use of event studies, which are basically studies that attempt to determine whether a particular event, and here be a misrepresentation, had an effect on stock price. And Justice Kennedy expressly termed that a middle ground in the case and asked Halliburton's counsel to comment on it. And then there were several questions, including from the Chief Justice, whom everyone has viewed to be a critical vote in the case, about whether these event studies are accurate at discerning effects of misrepresentations on stock prices, how costly they are, and the like. And then the court returned to that theme with David Boies, who was arguing for the fund. Justice Kennedy asked why price impact couldn't be shown through event studies. And Justice Sotomayor said, well, plaintiffs currently are showing market efficiency at the class certification stage. By showing the market is efficient, then they can take advantage of the presumption, the basic presumption that they've relied on that market price. What, you know, would showing price impact, she asked, at the class certification stage, would that be a great deal more difficult than showing market efficiency, as they do now? And Boies said that showing price impact would be more difficult, that there would be increased costs to plaintiffs from discovery and expert testimony, and that it would delay class certification proceedings. He also attempted to argue that it wasn't necessary to determine price impact at the class certification stage because there are significant merits filters, he said, including summary judgment, that result in the dismissal of many cases at various stages and lessen the burdens on defendants. And I think he was trying to suggest to the court that they shouldn't be worried about needing to throw up another barrier or hurdle in the form of a price impact showing at the class certification stage. But the Chief Justice jumped in at that point and said, but most private securities fraud suits, they never reach the merits. And the funds counsel agreed with that because it's true, very few of them do. And then Justice Scalia, interestingly, jumped in and said, well, the law professor's position would be consistent with the PLSRA. They would continue to allow the whole scheme to function. You can't point to anything in federal law that would become inoperative if plaintiffs had to show price impact at the class certification stage. And Boies responded that the PLSRA would make sense, but that a follow-up statute called SLUSA, which was designed to keep many of these class actions from ending up in state court after Congress had placed limits on the suits in federal court, he said that SLUSA would make less sense because it had relied, he argued, on the basic presumption of reliance. The government was supporting the fund in this case, and they divided the argument time. So Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart argued after Mr. Boies on behalf of the United States and the SEC, and he started with the same place that Justice Kagan had began the argument, which was with overruling BASIC and whether circumstances had changed enough to call into question the BASIC decision. But the Chief Justice again turned the argument right back to the second question, by asking, well, how prevalent and feasible were event studies back in the late 1980s when BASIC was decided? And the government acknowledged that event studies were likely more prevalent now and probably far more sophisticated. And then Justices Breyer and Alito asked questions about whether price impact is the kind of question that should be decided at the class certification stage. And there were arguments back and forth about whether it's more similar to the things that get decided at class certification or whether it's more similar to things that get decided on the merits. And at that point, Justice Kagan asked Deputy SG Stewart for the SEC's views on both of the questions because the SEC is the regulator in this area. And the government said that overruling BASIC would have dramatic consequences. And at that point, or shortly thereafter, Justice Kennedy jumped in and turned it back and said, okay, well, but what about the lesser step? What about the second question? What if we retained a presumption of reliance, but we focused on price impact at the class certification stage, maybe through event studies or something else? And the government said that the consequences of that lesser step or that middle ground would be less dramatic. And then finally in rebuttal, Halliburton's counsel, I think, responding largely to the point by Mr. Boies that there were merits filters for these cases, pointed out to the court some statistics about the vast majority of class certification motions are granted, and most cases never make it to summary judgment because they settle after class certification. So I think he was just trying to drive home for the court that whether plaintiffs can invoke a presumption of reliance at the class certification stage is hugely important to plaintiffs and defendants in a way that is not fully dealt with by other requirements that plaintiffs have to satisfy. So my takeaway, Dean, and this is kind of my wrap up, and then I would love to hear questions from everyone, is that although much of the commentary leading up to today focused on the first question and overruling BASIC, and made some fairly bold and far-reaching predictions about what that would do one way or the other, either retaining BASIC or overruling it to private securities fraud suits, there was much less talk of that this morning at the court. The court seemed much more focused on, in the event that they do retain a presumption and that BASIC survives in some form, what should that look like? What should the plaintiffs have to show by way of impact on price? Or should defendants be allowed to rebut that showing and establish that a misstatement did not affect price? So if you were judging just based on the oral argument, it seemed as if a potential coalition of justices was searching for a way to retain the presumption, but only in cases where there was some showing that the alleged misrepresentations had actually impacted securities prices. Dean, that's it for me.
Very good. Thank you so much. As always, now we're going to turn to our audience for your questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Mr. Jeffrey Wall, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. And while we're waiting to see if folks are going to ring in, let me make a brief announcement about our schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. So far next week, we have calls on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. On Monday, we'll be discussing the new Communications Act. On Tuesday, we'll be talking about originalism with Professors John McGinnis and Michael Rapoport and Professor Michael Greva. And then on Wednesday, we'll be talking about CyPre. That's the mechanism by which courts award residual class action settlements to third parties. Of course, today we're talking to Jeffrey Wall about the Halliburton case. If you have a question, we need you to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. Let me start while we wait to see if folks are going to ring in and ask you, in a lot of the press I've heard about this case in the run-up to this case, it stands to be one of the most important business cases in the court in the last 5 to 10 years or so. Is that the case only if if the earlier case is overturned, or if this sort of coalition of justices that you mentioned that's looking for a middle ground, possibly, if they find that middle ground and maybe require a price impact, showing a price impact at the pre-certification stage, is that significant enough to make it one of the most important business cases in the last 5 to 10 years? What's your sense on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure that you would get agreement on that even among people who litigate in this area. I have talked to plenty of securities litigators who think that a decision on QP2 on price impact would be extremely significant, and some others who are more skeptical. But I do think that most of the predictions that people were making, saying that this stood to be one of the most significant business cases in 15 or 20 years, probably were predicated on the assumption that the court was prepared to do something very serious with BASIC. which seemed fairly reasonable. Last term in Amgen, four justices, Justices Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, and Alito, all questioned BASIC. And so I think when the court granted this case, a lot of people jumped to the conclusion that they thought there were the votes to overrule BASIC, and I think that would fairly significantly alter private securities fraud suit under Section 10. There are other sections of the Securities Act that would not be affected, but Section 10 suits would be. And I just think it was less clear from argument this morning that the court is poised to take that far-reaching a step. And so I suspect that you're going to see people start to rein in their predictions, and my guess is that there'll still be disagreement even among practitioners in this area over exactly how meaningful the price impact ruling would be. Both of the parties this morning pointed out that the Second Circuit has allowed defendants to rebut the presumption of reliance at the class certification stage. So it may be that the court authors an opinion that directs courts of appeals to come closer to the Second Circuit's approach. I think that would still be important. It would still be a meaningful change in the area. But I don't know that you would find people saying that it would be the sort of watershed decision that they thought they might get out of BASIC Halliburton when the court granted.
And you said in Amgen there were four justices who seemed to signal a willingness to revisit BASIC. In addition to those four justices, is there a fifth or a sixth or even a seventh who is among today's coalition looking for an alternate? And I suppose you don't have the sense in particular that those justices were searching for the middle of the road so that it could be dismissed, so then they could say in good conscience, we've just got to overturn BASIC.
Well, that's the interesting thing. Justice Kennedy, of the four who last term in Amgen raised questions about BASIC and its rationale. Justice Kennedy was the one today who floated out the middle ground proposal, what he called it, the middle ground, of using event studies at the class certification stage to try to determine price impact. And Justice Scalia asked a question at one point that suggested that he might also be comfortable with that middle ground, which I suspect was a surprise to many people. So I think going into today, opponents of BASIC thought that they needed the four justices who'd questioned BASIC in Amgen, and then I'm sure that they were hoping to pick up other votes, including the Chief Justice's vote. And so to see some members of the either the Amgen dissent or Justice Alito who concurred indicating that they might be comfortable with the middle ground, I think that's why you see early press reports saying that it's difficult to count to five for overruling BASIC. Now, again, it's always hazardous to predict outcomes based on just the oral argument alone, but there was very little talk of overruling BASIC this morning, and I'm not even sure if there was a single question that was strictly about stare decisis. There were several questions about what Congress had intended and done through the years and whether Congress in various statutes like the PLSRA had relied on BASIC in a way that might call for the court not to disturb it. But there was very little talk about straight stare decisis and whether the court should adhere to its previous opinion, even if it thought maybe that opinion had been wrongly decided. It was really a non-factor in the discussion.
Interesting. We do have a couple callers with questions now. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, Jeffrey. This is Andy Yurko in Southern California. What was the extent of Justice Alito's participation in the hearing? As you're aware, he's pretty much intimately involved with this issue going back to Burlington Coat Factory in 97. I was just wondering what his participation was in this.
Hi, Andy. He asked several questions. I would say of the members of the court, he seemed the one that was most friendly to Halliburton's position and most skeptical about the fund's position. He asked several questions, I think, that were sort of getting at the practical realities of this, and that if you don't determine it on class certification, you are unlikely ever to get a decision on the merits of price impact or anything else. And so, he didn't make clear as between the what I would call the strong position of overruling BASIC and the fallback position of maybe tightening the requirements to invoke the presumption. I don't think that he did anything to make clear as between those two positions which one he would favor. But he did seem through several of his questions to indicate that he has skepticism about the way that it currently plays out in practice. And so if you take a look at the transcript, you'll see he pressed Mr. Boies on some practical questions at times about the way these actions really work on the ground. So I think he seemed to have some real practical concerns about the way that the presumption of reliance functions now. And so I suspect that he will he seemed more inclined to do something other than just affirm and leave things the way they are now.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Yes, David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley. In connection with the fraud on the market, there's this kind of bundled assumption about the efficient market hypothesis. And I guess my question is that was there any concern expressed or do you have any concern that if the efficient market hypothesis itself is diminished in status, in this case, would that potentially spread into other cases where there's an implied efficient market hypothesis, for example, in insider trading or other forms of actions relating to securities and the disclosure of information?
Well, that was that was one of the most interesting things about the argument to me. There's so much about that in the briefs, in both the parties' briefs and in the amicus filings about not just whether markets are efficient and how efficient they are, but also the ways in which that notion, the kind of efficiency of markets, has worked its way in, as you point out, to other areas of the securities laws. And some of respondents' amici, I think, really went to great lengths to say that if you question it here in Halliburton, that could have adverse consequences for other areas of the securities laws. And if you look at the transcript, Justice Ginsburg started out there fairly early on, not exactly with your question, but she said, look, if you look at Justice Blackmun's opinion in BASIC, yes, he does talk about the efficiency of capital markets, but there are a number of other things that ground his opinion there, including, she says, common sense. And so, I think what she was getting at right off the bat was, we can decide this case without saying anything about the efficiency of markets. Perhaps because she had your concern. And as I say, one of the most interesting things about the argument was that even though that's where it started with questions by Justice Kagan and Justice Ginsburg, it really did not play out along those lines. Those concerns largely dropped out after the chief asked his question about how he could possibly resolve the debate in the economic literature over the efficiency of markets. And so I think it's a great question, and I wish I had more to tell you, except that the court may have been sensitive to that, and it may be why they didn't seem to want to go down the efficiency and inefficiency road.
Thank you.
We've got a few minutes left. We've got quite a few people on the line. If you have a question for Mr. Jeffrey Wall, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Make this a last call for questions. Well, seeing none, Mr. Ball, let me do thank you for not only your time this afternoon, but of course for attending oral argument this morning. We maybe we can have you back along with our callers from yesterday. After we get a decision here, it'll be interesting. We look forward to that. To our audience, of course, please consult the Federalist Society calendar for upcoming telephone conference calls. As of now, our next scheduled call is Monday, and hope to see you all then. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.